speaker, and we're pulling up his slide right now. Mark Peterman is from Ondavia, Inc. Mark is a serial entrepreneur with broad technical and business experience. He founded a recycling company at the age of 13, and he led programming efforts for environmental compliance software at a startup during his undergraduate studies and invented core technologies during his applied physics doctoral studies. And this provided the foundation for three startup companies. So we're going to hear from Mark today. He's going to talk about on-site laboratory-grade rapid response testing. And Mark, at this point, I would like to hand it over to you.
Sounds great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the chance to talk a little bit about the work, research, and the things we've done at Ondavia over the past 6 years, and I appreciate the audience out there tuning in to listen to a little bit of it. As Heather said, my name is Mark Peterman. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Ondavia. When we founded the company six years ago in 2009, our mission was to make laboratory-grade water testing fast and easy. And that's remained our exclusive focus, providing an end-to-end solution for our customers and partners to get quantitative results in an aqueous sample. And what we provide is the capability to do on-site laboratory-grade rapid response testing for trace contaminants in water. Now, this is a little bit of preaching to the choir, I'm sure, based on the other companies and other folks that will be speaking today and the audience that's out there. But I want to set up the problem a little bit, and maybe others will be able to expand upon this as we move forward. We saw that traditional laboratory-based water analysis is slow and complex. A few years back, we were involved in a project testing for trace contaminants in beach water after Deepwater Horizon. And that project required collecting at four different states, dozens of samples per site, 1 liter bottles, amber glass bottles, filling them with water from the beach, keeping them cold, have to be at 4 degrees C, packing them in coolers, lugging them all over the place so we could find a courier service and ship them to the lab. Not only was the laboratory testing itself expensive, but the cost to ship and the time and effort involved in handling all of that fluid was challenging, right? So, and once the samples reached the lab, they were put in the fridge. 3 weeks went by until eventually they were tested. And what we received was about a half ream of paper in the mail with all the test reports. And even 5 years ago, this seemed, even at that time, that seemed archaic. In this century, we should be able to get data in a digital format, not have to receive a good chunk of a tree with test reports to get a few pieces of information. What we devised in response to that is what we call the Ondavia analysis system. You work with a small sample, 10 mils of sample typically, often much less. The advantage there is the user is dealing with less hazardous material, so there's less sample that and less potential risk. You do your testing on site. Tests take less than 5 minutes. Some take only 30 seconds in our work. That gives you data quickly and gives you at the location where you need it. And we couple on the back end potential to do analytics. You record metadata with all of your testing, time, temperature, location, so on and so forth. So that if you want to do any type of big data or additional analyses or offline analysis, all the information is there in digital format for easy processing. And you go from being a three-week process that's well over $50 per test to being a five-minute test on-site for $50. Our technology has very broad capabilities, and we're always interested in discussing with partners other potential testing opportunities because we have the ability to measure nearly any compound in any liquid from part per billion all the way up through percent level measurements. We've done a tremendous amount of work with amines and triazines used for hydrogen sulfide scavenging, corrosion control, also their pesticide used for disinfectants. And have more recently started working with a lot of oxyanions, selenate, arsenate, hexchrome, perchlorate, so on and so forth. And we're really pushing hard on development of those products. More recently started to move into chlorinated solvents, TCE, chlorinated hydrocarbons of various sorts, disinfection byproducts, and that's some of our upcoming work. And actually within the last couple weeks, took a quick look at lead, part per billion level, 5 minute test, actually 2 minute test, at low part per billion level in drinking water, pretty simple, straightforward application, something new we're excited about. And our overall vision for how this approach would work is the user chooses single-use test kits. They're consumables, analyte-specific, currently single analyte per test, but we're working on multiplexing, multiple analytes. You couple those with any pretreatment that might be necessary, a little filtration, maybe oxidation to put analytes in an appropriate state, and then an instrument and software. One instrument reads all of our cartridges, so you can look at the menu, choose which test you want to do, and one instrument reads all of it, coupled with very easy-to-use software that stores all the data and does all the analysis. Our technology is based on surface-enhanced Raman spectroscopy. SERS has been known since the 70s, so it's a very well-known technique, but it's had an Achilles heel. It has not been very repeatable to date. At Ondavia, we've solved that. We've made it truly a quantitative analytical test that we're rolling out in real commercial availability. I show here some example data of ethanolamine testing that was done over the course of a summer. We had a student intern come in, no experience previously with our system in any way, shape, or form, came on in and was able to run hundreds of samples for ethanolamine, 25 ppm, 75 ppm samples over the course of a summer, and get the results you see plotted there. We're getting results that are not only faster and easier to use than any laboratory method like ion chromatography, but also giving results that are better in terms of repeatability and accuracy than you would be able to get with an IC. Now I'll go into a couple applications here, some specific things we're working on more recently. Selenium analysis. The selenium exists predominantly as selenate and selenite in natural water, so the +6 and +4 oxidation state. In drinking water applications, folks are usually interested in a 50 part per billion detection limit, although some states have pushed lower than that. And very recently, some new changes are forcing coal-fired power plants to go to even lower levels, 12 part per billion or lower, for selenium in some of their wastewater streams. Currently, if you want to do this type of testing, you do colorimetry, get you to 50 ppb. If you want to do better, you're going to do ICP-MS. And you can see on the right, we plot representative data for what we can do. We're actually now down to about a 5 part per billion total selenium detection limit in a few-minute test. But what's interesting, one of the things we find powerful with our technology is that we can actually provide speciation data because our test is very specific for the +6, the selenate oxidation state. So you can take a sample, a field sample, measure the amount of selenate that's present, then oxidize the entire sample with a little peroxide and a little heat, and then measure the total selenium content. The difference in natural waters is primarily the selenite concentration. So what would have been a very complex and expensive laboratory process to get the speciation data becomes a field test that could be done by with moderate training. And I give some example data here for some mine water samples, about 400 part per billion to begin with for selenium. We get numbers that are equivalent to it. But these samples were going through a biological reduction process for treatment. When we measured the treated water, we saw no selenium at all, even though some was present. And that's because all that selenium had been reduced to either zero or to plus four. When we went ahead and oxidized those samples, the selenium was then all converted back to selenate, and we got numbers comparable to what you get from ICP-MS. So a quick, easy way to do a speciation test in the field. We're looking at doing similar things with arsenic. Arsenic exists in natural waters primarily as arsenite and arsenate, 3 and 5 oxidation states. Regulatory folks are usually interested in 10 part per billion total arsenic. That's what the levels are. But arsenic 3 is actually more hazardous than arsenic 5. Plus, knowing the ratio of 3 to 5 can affect your treatment process. So knowing that information can give you the ability to optimize a test or optimize treatment if you might have more of one versus the other. Currently, you can get a total arsenic number via colorimetry. In which you generate arsine gas, which is not necessarily the safest approach, but it does work for a colorimetric test. And you can do speciation via hydride generation atomic absorption spectroscopy, not something that you might want to roll out in the field and do on site in a remote location. So at Ondavia, we have worked to develop two tests. This is not oxidation. These are two direct measurements for arsenite and arsenate, each with a sub-10 part per billion detection limit, actually getting pretty close to 5 on both of those, and continue to push that technology forward, hopefully moving into a phase 2 SBIR in the near future. Our target specifications for these two, for arsenic and selenium, in effect, for many of the oxyanions, is all of them were pushing sub 10 part per billion detection limits with a 5-minute test. Make this easy, give data that is relevant and in the field. Plus the ability to speciate, so 3 versus 5 or 4 versus 6. Our selenium test is commercially available, and the arsenic one is available for beta testing. We've also just recently, we're in the middle of a phase one effort, SBR effort, for a trichloroethylene test. Again, 5-minute test, looking at a 5 ppb detection limit. Early stage, I'm going to show you, I can only show a little bit of data here, don't have the calibration curve up yet, but here we see the spectrum at the bottom, a Raman spectrum, with and without TC present. A small amount of TC leads to a pretty sizable signal, and we're continuing to push development forward there and looking for stakeholders and who we might partner on that development effort. And I'll wrap up by saying that what we've developed is the first ever commercially available, quantitative, repeatable analytical methods using SIRS, surface enhanced Raman spectroscopy. We have very broad applicability from anions to metals to VOCs. So you can combine the GC, the IC, and the HPLC, put them all together, and use our system instead. And we have application of QA, QC through process control, through environmental monitoring and remediation. It's also important that we'll point out that the arsenic and TC work was funded through the NIHSBR program. So we appreciate the support of the NIEHS on this work. And definitely thank the U.S. taxpayer for funding the SBR program. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks very much for your presentation. At this point, we can encourage the audience participants to submit questions via the Q&A box. All you have to do is type in your question, and it will appear only to the host. So it will not appear to all the other participants on the phone. So Mark, I had a question. I just was wondering if you have had the opportunity. It sounds like you've done a number of site work, or at least working on real-world samples. Could you tell us a little bit about how you've been able to apply the technologies that you have developed to date?
Yeah, so we have definitely gone out with a few different tests to do some field work across a variety of industries, everywhere from remediation through oil and gas applications. You know, the system's about the size of a shoebox, runs off 12 volts, so it's pretty easy to drop in a Pelican case and show up, you know, out in the middle of a desert field somewhere where there's a hole in the ground, and as water's coming up, be able to test it on site. So we've done that for things from selenium, perchlorate, boron, a range of different analytes. We've been able to do that type of work.
Great, so finding lots of application for that. And just in terms of the unit itself, what is its longevity or projected time that, you know, that the parts would, is there a need for regular tune-ups, so to speak, or instrumentation tweaking from time to time?
You know, it's rather robust. The one form of calibration is there's a hardware alignment which we provide a polystyrene substrate that gives a Raman spectrum and can be used to align the hardware properly. Beyond that, it's about a 5-year lifetime on the laser, and it can be replaced if needed, but usually that's about the lifetime we'd expect on these systems. You know, in a Pelican case, I'm taking them, you know, all over the world in the belly of an airplane, and they're making the trip quite well. I think a 1-meter drop test off a table in the current design, it would likely not pass. But we are working on always making the system more robust and more portable, and listening to the needs out there as we make those changes.
Great. And a question came in. I think this is a good one. What have you seen in terms of environmental regulators' receptivity to the technology?
Yeah, it's still a little bit open. A lot of the applications, we've specifically looked at applications where it has not been a regulatory, it's a process control type application where folks want to get rapid data on how a system's working without having to go through the laboratory. Samples are still being taken for the regulatory process, right? They're being taken and sent as needed, but being able to turn the crank as an adjusting knob getting a system running or when there's a fault. That's where the power is. We've had very early conversations on the regulatory side. Those are things that we would like to move more into. But to date, we've based on size and resources, focused more on process control type testing. Always open to those discussions and working with folks on how to make that transition.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be, an important move forward for any of our technologies today, certainly, to figure out how to navigate that process. I think at this time we might just move on, and thank you very much, Mark, for your informative presentation.
Thank you.
Certainly invite people to still submit questions, and if you want to direct them towards Mark, we'll be sure that he gets those questions and make sure that he follows up with you, because, again, the purpose of this webinar is to create some interface between the investigators, the grantees, as well as people who may potentially be using these technologies in the future. So next, I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Vikas Vaida. He's from Lintec. He is a senior scientist at Lintec and received his doctorate degree in analytical chemistry from Iowa State University and a master's degree in analytical chemistry and organic chemistry from Bowling Green State University and Tribhuvan University, respectively. He has over 25 years of combined experience in applied research and development in project management. His research interest is focused on understanding and controlling the chemistry of materials. This is achieved through various methods of synthesis and modification. These innovative modified materials find application in enhancing separation and detection of toxic materials, including chemicals and biological agents, and in the development of novel methods and analysis of environmental samples. And today he's going to be talking about arsenic in water. So, Vikas, I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about your research.
Thank you, Heather.
We can hear you loud and clear.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Heather, very much for this great introduction and also giving us this opportunity to tell everybody about this research we're doing at Lintec for detection of arsenic in water. This is an ongoing phase one, so I do not have the amount of data and the results that Mark just showed. He did a lot of good work with very different things. Research on this project is focused only on arsenic, so it's not, don't expect to see like many different things. But it is also different. This is going to be something that is relatively cheap, and it is going to be small. Arsenic is actually found in water at many different parts of the world. This exists in natural waters, and this has been causing many, many health effects, actually to millions, hundreds of millions of people in like 70 different countries. And these arsenic is also causing many different health problems with like dermal poisoning from drinking water, large number of liver, lung, kidney, and many other cancers has been observed as people drink water containing arsenic. And this arsenic is very toxic even at very low levels. The WHO has set up the safe drinking level of arsenic in water at 10 ppb. So currently, as Mark mentioned, there are a few different ways of measuring this arsenic in water, but many of these people or the water that's drinking water affected by arsenic exists in third world country, like Bangladesh is very heavily affected by this. And for places like this, we need something that is relatively low cost and very easy to use. But the currently available this detection kits, they are, like mentioned earlier, they are colorimetric based, and they also generate arsine gas, which is also very toxic. And On top of that, these are only qualitative. They do not give quantitative numbers. So to address these needs, we are actually trying to develop something that is very, very convenient, and that can be used by anybody without any special training. And on this slide, you can see, like on the bottom right, we just have a conceptual design where we think like we would like to be able to just take the sample water and push through a cartridge, and we would like to be able to read it just using a very low-cost colorimeter. So this one is on a little bit bigger. So to do this, we want to come up with a very simple dry disposable cartridge so that it can be shipped to the site where it's needed at a low cost. And this would also have a long shelf life. And when this is combined with a colorimeter, a relatively low-cost colorimeter, it would be able to give a quantitative reading just in a few minutes. And this is the approach that we, this is the vision we had. And then on the next slide, we will show you like what we have achieved so far. In this left cartridge here, we have been able to contain all the reagents that's required to develop color from arsenic-containing water. And then once the water goes through this many layers, like there are chemistries that's designed to occur at each different levels of this. The first layer here we have is ion exchange reagent to take out phosphorus, phosphates, because we have found in our test system phosphates heavily interfere. So we put a step in there to remove the phosphate. After that, there are other chemicals that oxidize arsenic 3 to arsenic 5, and then it creates another complex, and then it binds with an indicator dye, which is captured in a second cartridge. And then we read the captured color, the color developed in the cartridge that you can see here on top right. When there is arsenic, the color goes darker green, corresponding to the amount of arsenic remaining. As I mentioned earlier, we are at the very early stage of development of this process. So we are still trying to make these processes a little bit more rugged. Right now, we have to make this more reproducible and more linear. But from these early experiments, we were able to see like 5 ppb, or we might be able to see even lower, but we have not attempted it because of these cartridges. All these are assembled by hand one at a time, and so we don't have the uniformity required to get this data more reliably. And another advantage of this is with this method, we can actually also get the speciation of arsenic 3 and arsenic 5. If we do not use the oxidizing agent, then it will only detect arsenic 5. If we want to get the total arsenic, then we have included in the cartridge an oxidizing layer that will convert all the arsenic 3 into arsenic 5, and then we will the system will detect both arsenic 3 and 5. So it, even being like this disposable cartridge, and this could be taken to the field, and the main advantage of this is there is no necessary of handling any liquid reagents. There are all the reasons, although this reaction happens under acidic conditions, on the bottom of this, the capture the detection cartridge, we have put a neutralization layer. So what comes out is already neutralized and safe. And once these are used, these can be safely disposed because these cartridges does not contain any toxic metals or other chemicals that cannot be safely disposed into the environment. So this is what we have done so far, and we are still working on development of the reader that can be manufactured at a very low cost. Our target for this is to make the reader less than $200, and we hope to make these cartridges to be less than $1 per test. And so just to summarize, these benefits of these, our approach would be that we can detect both arsenic 3 and arsenic 5, and this is also gives us a quantitative results using a colorimeter. For qualitative, we can also be used, we can put this into a strip and we can just color match, but that kind of test already exists in the market. And this is also very quick. All we need to do is like just push the liquid through the cartridge and we can just read within a minute. This does not require any skilled operator. This is very safe. It doesn't use any toxic metals like the currently existing colorimetric methods use. And this, as we have all of these reagents and the indicators all in a dry form, this will have a long shelf life, which makes it useful to take it to this remote places. And I mentioned earlier, we found out that phosphate really interfered, so we have added a layer to remove the phosphate in the cartridges. And I think I went really fast, but I'd like to again thank Heather and the Superfund Research Program for funding this project. And I'm ready for any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Vikas. At this time, we are welcoming any questions to come in through the Q&A pod. To write a question, all you have to do is find the Q&A pod in the Windows. Type in your question and then hit the little bubble button next to it, and that will submit your question. And when you do that, the only people who will see the questions are the host. So we encourage people to submit questions. So Vikas, in listening to your presentation, I just was wondering if part of, you know, maybe a potential application for this technology might be for community-based, you know, measurement of environmental samples, or agree that this is a very user-friendly technology?
Yes, that's a great question. I think actually the one that when we were looking into this, I thought like, oh, this is really required in places like Bangladesh and India, where there is the arsenic in water is very prevalent. But as I started developing, I also found that actually there are a large number of people in the United States, especially in the Western United States, they are also having problem with arsenic in drinking water, especially the ones who have their own wells. So they get their drinking water from their own wells. Like many of them have this arsenic levels, and many of them they may not even know. And since the testing is not very convenient, many of them do not test that too. So this will help because this will be something that any people at home, they can just take it and just push a little bit of their water sample and they can read out, and it will be very useful. But it is also useful for the environmental, but I think this can even go to the household level.
Okay. Great. And again, the type of – one of the reasons why you thought it was, you know, particularly easy is that it's a color-based test. Is that correct?
Yes, it is color-based test, and with the reader that we can put it, it will actually give you the number directly. It can read.
Okay.
We have to do some modifications to match it. It is color is there, but the way we have configured it in the cartridges – it is difficult to read without breaking it open. We actually moved the to show you the picture, we took it out, we cut it open, but which is not practical for the ultimate user. So we have to come up with something different. But if we can cut down the price of the reader, like, you know, right now the cost of this all electronics has been so low. It might even be possible to make an adapter that can go onto a cell phone, you know, and it can read the color, and it still, that way it will be quantitative rather than just qualitative.
Yeah, that would be a great modification.
But right now we are developing something using relatively cheap photodiode and LEDs. So that would be, it could be, I think, like when they manufacture, it will be very low price. Right now, when we buy off the shelf parts, it costs us just over $100 to put it together.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so in terms of the stage, are you at the prototype stage, or where would you say you are?
Oh, we are at very, very early stages. We still need a lot more to make this chemistry rugged. We are able to do this, but it is not very consistent. We have not completely understood the chemistry. And we are now looking into testing the interferences. We have started that, and we found phosphate is a big problem, but that we found a solution to eliminate. It doesn't seem to matter too much with the other commonly found anions or cations in water system. But we still have to do like other tests, like, you know, we have not, I said, like, if it is dry, it would last longer, but we have to prove that too. We're just starting those kind of tests, and we also have to optimize the range. Right now, this is, works around like 5 to 50 ppb, but we would like to expand the dynamic range also. We may have to make separate sets, but we have not, we're studying that right now.
Well, great, and again, just to reiterate, that's part of the purpose of these webinars is to bring our technology developers, even though it is early stages, just to have a chance for some feedback from audience participants and to reach out to more potential stakeholders or end users. I want to give anybody who's on the phones a chance to ask a question as well. If you want to ask a question, you first have to take your phone off mute, and to do that, you would need to press #6 to unmute your line. So I'll give, since we have a little bit of time, why don't I just turn it over, #6, and see if anyone on the phone line has any questions. And again, people are welcome to use the Q&A pod to submit questions. So, Bikas, thank you so much for your presentation. I think what we'll
Heather,
do is...
Heather, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt, but do you see the question? There's several questions have been submitted. I just want to make sure you didn't miss them.
I missed them. Thanks.
Okay. Are you able to see the Q&A pod?
I do now.
Okay. Just checking. Yeah, so several questions came through if you want to ask them.
Okay. And these were all for Bikas?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. How does your test handle the turbidity of the sample?
Actually, the turbidity to handle, because we have this layered structure of these cartridges, let me get back to this. Our cartridge has like different layers, and these are many of these are supported on a glass filter. So any of these like insoluble materials, they are separated out. So this will only detect soluble forms of arsenic. So if there are arsenic that is insoluble or attached to the other material, this test will not detect. But since it is for the drinking water, we don't expect a lot of turbidity. Hope that answers your question.
Sure. Thank you. Another question was, are there any hazards involved in having the oxidizer in the column?
The oxidizer is a very small quantity inside, and actually as it goes through the reaction steps, those are already neutralized. And when it comes out, it would be pH is somewhere between 5 and 8 or something like that.
Okay, great. And you mentioned that the technology is still in development. When do you expect it to be available for actual use?
Oh, I think, I hope, like, if it goes everything as planned, we will be submitting a phase 2 soon. So maybe in 3-4 years at the earliest.
Okay. Great. I'm just running through these questions now because there were a lot submitted. I just didn't see them. Your preliminary results appear more qualitative than quantitative, and I think we're on the right screen to look at that, slide 4.
Yes.
Hence the nonlinearity. How are you planning to make the detection more quantitative?
Oh, as I mentioned earlier, we are in very early stage, and right now we are trying to control the release of the different, control the rate of the release of the different reagents and the indicators. That's what we're optimizing, and that's the major part of the research that's remaining. We have shown that concept works, so to make it quantitative, we have to have a controlled release, and that would be our next step. That's what we are planning to do in our phase 2 of this project.
And then do you, how are you going to distinguish between the speciation between arsenate and arsenite? And also, are there any other ions that can be causes of interferences or any chemicals?
We have not tested all the possible potentials, but we tested normally found cations and anions in water, and phosphate was the only one that seemed to interfere with the step, so we included a layer to remove the phosphate. And regarding the speciation, as I mentioned earlier, this test detects arsenic 5. So if we want to detect total arsenic, we have to use the cartridge that include oxidizing agent. If we want to find out the arsenic 3 and 5 differently, we need to run two cartridges, one with oxidizer and one without, and the difference will give you the arsenic 3.
Great, and I certainly appreciate all the questions that came in, and Bikas for your excellent fielding of all those questions. Thank you very much. I think at this point, since there are no more online questions, we can move on to our next speaker. However, do encourage folks to continue to submit questions if you want. If we don't get a chance to go back and answer your questions, we will be sure to connect them with the presenters for following up offline. So we'll move on to our final speaker for today, Wayne Vimar and Lily Hay from Algitron. Wayne Vimar is a U.S. Navy veteran and has over 30 years' experience as an analytical chemist. Prior to joining Algitron, Dr. Vimar was a research chemist for 10 years at the Naval Weapons Center, China Lake, identifying reaction mechanisms on non-equilibrium thin film material reactors, including plasma-assisted chemical vapor deposition of diamond and laser ablation deposition of high-temperature superconductor materials. Dr. Vimar then spent 5 years with Texas Instruments Raytheon, where he developed low-cost polymer optics for infrared imaging systems, including several military systems and the Cadillac night vision system. Dr. Vimar spent the next 2.5 years as a senior research chemist and group manager at Zyvex Corporation, where he developed ultra-sensitive chemical detectors for real-time monitoring of nanosynthesis. Dr. Vimar then founded U.S. Detection Technologies, where he was chief technology officer and managed the development of ultra-sensitive chemical detection system. He holds a PhD in analytical chemistry from the University of Wyoming and has published over 50 articles in scientific and technical journals and is named as inventor on 2 patents and 1 pending. Lilly is assistant professor of food science at University of Massachusetts Amherst. She received her PhD from the University of Missouri Columbia in 2009 and did her postdoc training at the University of Minnesota between 2009 and 2012. Then she joined the faculty in the food science department at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and as an assistant professor in 2012. Dr. Hayes' major research focus is to develop and apply the most advanced and innovative analytical techniques to help solve critical and emerging issues in food science. The central tool of Lilly's research is surface-enhanced Raman spectroscopy, and her group has developed several SIRS-based technologies for food safety and food chemistry applications. In food safety applications, she developed various rapid SIRS methods for detecting chemical, biological, and engineered nanoparticle contaminants in complex food matrices. In food chemistry applications, she applied SIRS for the characterization of food components and their interactions. And today we're going to hear about the portable SIRS technology for detection of trace-level PAHs. So I'll pass it over to the Algitron team.
Well, thank you, Heather, for the invitation to present here in front of so many stakeholders. It'll be interesting to get their feedback following this presentation. I'd like to first introduce other members of the team, Anika Wilson here at Agiletron. Of course, we've had the great fortune to be in partnership with Lilly He, who's contributed greatly to the success of this project. Okay, well, first let me begin by stating the problem, and then I will bring our solution to the fore. The problem is fairly obvious. The groundwater and soil samples samples at Superfund sites are contaminated with polyaromatic hydrocarbons at trace levels. These are highly toxic compounds that are a result of mostly combustion processes, and they persist in the environment for a very, very long time. In fact, they are so toxic that the Environmental Protection Agency has listed 16 as priority pollutants. Exacerbating the problem is that current methods for detection of PAHs require samples to be sent to the laboratory for laboratory testing, and that field tests that do exist lack the required sensitivity to detect samples that are near or below the maximum contamination level established by the EPA, that is 0.2 part per billion. So the samples that need to be sent to the laboratory take about a week turnaround, and they cost between $50 and $100 per sample. The lack of the field tests is a big problem, because if you're trying to evaluate 10 to 30 acres of land, how on earth do you do an adequate sampling system when every single sample has to be packaged and sent to a laboratory? If you had an on-site field test unit, you could sample almost as many samples as you wanted. And say you would sample, make a grid of 100, and then make it finer where you found contamination and so forth. Very much becomes a matter of developing an adequate sampling plan to adequately survey a Superfund site. The solution we bring to the table is we are going to use surface-enhanced Raman spectroscopy in a unique way to detect all 16 of these PAHs at a level below the minimum contaminant level established by the EPA of 0.1 part per billion level. In fact, that's half of what the EPA MCL is. The innovation that we bring to this project is the use of an effective hydrophobic partition layer that will be used to extract PAHs directly from water samples for immediate, rapid, and ultra-sensitive detection. I will explain how this works momentarily. But let me just say that our results to date have shown, our results to date in this, as a result of the phase one, have shown that the potential to achieve detection limits even below our target level of 0.1 part per billion. Let me very briefly describe Raman spectroscopy and our surface-enhanced Raman spectroscopy. You got a flavor of it from a previous talk. But Raman spectroscopy identifies unknown molecules by detecting their unique chemical bonding structure. So it essentially detects the bonds that make up the analyte molecules in your sample. Raman spectroscopy is a routine analytical method employed in labs throughout the world, but it's useful at bulk concentrations. So, for example, if you wanted to test the purity of a material or to identify a impurity, Raman spectroscopy is a very good technique, but it is not very sensitive. One of the beauties of Raman spectroscopy is that very little sample preparation is necessary. So let me move your attention down to the lower left figure there. To do a Raman measurement, you simply place samples on a surface, for example, or they could be contained in a vial or any form of plastic bottle, and you simply shine a laser onto the sample, and what you measure is the Raman scattered light that comes back and is emitted by the sample following irradiation by a laser. Well, that Raman scattered light that you will detect is shifted in frequency from the frequency of the laser, an amount equal to the vibration frequency of a bond that's in the molecule. So if your molecule has a lot of different bonds, the Raman scattered light will contain frequency shifted light components at various frequency shifts. So you measure all of the light that's Raman scattered from the sample. You disperse that into its frequency components, and then you plot it out, as is what's shown in the lower right, to produce what's known as a Raman spectrum. So we're plotting intensity of all these different frequency-shifted light components that come off the sample. A Raman shift of zero would be where the probe laser is. And all of these different other components of the spectrum are due to the different bonds that comprise the sample. The peak scores correspond to distinct bond vibrations that are in the sample. But the main point I want to drive home here is that that spectrum is invariant. It is not changed for that analyte that's being measured or that mixture that's being measured. So if you measure that sample on one day and you create one of these Raman spectra, if you go back and measure that sample 6 months later, you should create an identical Raman spectrum. They do not change because you are actually measuring a very fundamental property of your sample. So because of this invariance and reproducibility in Raman spectroscopy, a measured spectrum is obtained, and then that spectrum can be compared to a library of spectra that you measured previously in order to identify what's in the sample. So if you had a list of samples, let's just say you had 18 priority EPA PAHs that you were interested in measuring, you would measure 16, each of those PAH samples, store them in a library, and then you would measure an unknown and to see and compare that spectrum that you measured to each of those 16 spectra in the library. If there was a mathematical match, then you would have the identity. And the intensity of the measured spectrum is proportional to the concentration of the analyte molecules, so therefore you could determine concentration with a single measurement. So by shining a laser on a sample, measuring the spectrum, you can pair it in a few milliseconds to a set of library spectra and identify and quantify your sample that way. Well, like I said, Raman spectroscopy is not sensitive enough to get to trace levels. CSIRS extends the method, this Raman spectroscopy method, to trace level detection, typically in the part per billion range. But we're going to push it below the part per billion range. We've observed that the signal enhanced by our CSIRS technology enhances the Raman scattered light by 8 orders of magnitude due to strong local plasmonic electric fields that are formed adjacent to nanostructured substrate media. And so what I mean is, if you look at that lower left figure, if you were to coat that surface with one of our CSIRS materials and then put the analytes on that surface, you could enhance the Raman scattered light by 8 orders of magnitude, and that would allow you to get to trace level detection. Our strategy in our phase one, our overall phase one and phase two objective, is to adapt our handheld Raman spectrometer. We have a commercially available Raman spectrometer called the Pinpointer. We would re-engineer that instrument to be able to accommodate cartridges that contained these CSIRS materials that we develop here at Agiltron. So you would essentially take a sample, inject it into a cartridge, and then plug it into the Raman spectrometer, push a button, it would measure it, and then within some minutes you would have your result. The technology behind this and where Lilly's great expertise came to play was, let's look at the lower figure on the lower left. You can see that we apply silver nanoparticle films to a quartz substrate. Okay, now we know how to engineer those films it's a very simple two-step process to produce those films that amplify the PAH signal by between 6 and 8 orders of magnitude. Where Lilly comes in, she's an expert at applying this alkane thiol self-assembled monolayers that are chemically bonded to our silver substrate, and they produce a hydrophobic partition layer. So if you expose that figure second to the right to a water sample, only those components in the water sample that are hydrophobic will flow from the water sample into this hydrophobic partition layer. And that's precisely the strategy we're going to use to extract very low levels of PAHs from water samples to get them very close to our SIRS substrate. So one of the properties of our SIRS substrates is that the analytes need to be very close to them. So this partition layer not only extracts the sample, analytes from the water sample, but it also brings them in close proximity to the SIRS substrate, so that in the right-hand figure, when you irradiate that substrate with the laser, the PAHs are the Raman scattered light from those PAHs is greatly, greatly enhanced. So we know how to make the substrates. Lilly knows how to make the partition layers, and we are both know how to do SIRS spectroscopy. And so we ended up being quite a great team. On the next slide, these are 7 of the 16 priority PAHs that we have measured. And just simply by looking at those various spectra, you can see that all of them have portions that are unique. So these would be 7 excellent spectra to place in a library so that if you measured a sample and it contained a combination of or any one of these PAHs, there would be plenty of spectral feature in them in order to produce a mathematical match. On the next slide are the remaining 9 PAHs that are a part of this program, and you can see again that each of those 9 spectra have unique features. The fact of the matter is that these were all measured, by the way, on partition layers on our SIRS substrates. So you can see that each of them, even though PAHs are a single chemical class of compounds, they all generate unique SIRS spectra. And as I mentioned before, these would be invariant, so we will measure these 16 and then store them in a library for use in an instrument that would be making measurements in the field. These are results that we obtained. I'm first going to look at the middle row of measurements, and these are calibration curves that were measured, and the range of measurement went from 0.1 part per billion to 1,000 part per billion. And what you can see is that the signal immediately rises and then saturates out. This is a combination of both the limited dynamic range of surface-mass Raman spectroscopy, but more importantly for this application, what you're really seeing there is that the partition layer has a limited capacity. It has a very limited capacity. However, it is extraordinarily sensitive right where you want it to be, and that is right by the maximum concentration limit that is set by the EPA. And if you look at the lower row of data, those data points plotted, but now the x-axis is the log value of concentration. And you can see that in each case, for all 3 of these PAHs, you can see that that relationship is linear. Now, the idea of using partition layers in surface-sense Raman spectroscopy is not new. But what is new are partition layers and SIRS substrates that produce those linear relationships down to the subpart per billion level, as is shown in that lower row of data. So that is what's really the key achievement that we have so far. So now I want to turn your attention to the top row of data for both the, for all three of these PAHs. These are second derivative spectra that were produced by Lilly, and they're stacked up. All of the different spectra are normalized and then overlaid on one another to show the signal intensity of all the different concentration measurements. So let's look at the upper left one for phenanthrene. The top trace there that's called the control is the SIRS substrate with partition layer with no sample applied. And then the rest of those traces are going from 0.1 to 1,000 part per billion. But if you notice the large gap between no sample and the lowest concentration that we measured, you can see that there is, in fact, a significant gap there. What that means is that there, we could probably push the detection limit even lower than 0.1 part per billion. And that is the same case if you go over to pyrene to the middle set of spectra, and if you go over to the right, the upper right set of spectra for that PAH. So the point is we've not only achieved our 0.1 part per billion limit of detection, which is sufficient to measure concentrations below the EPA maximum concentration limit, but we might even be able to push it even further, even lower than 0.1 part per billion. Okay, so finally, we can do all of these things in a lab, but can we do this in an instrument that's portable? What we show here are those same three PAHs, the SIRS spectra that were produced on one of our silver nanoparticle film substrates. And what you can see is in all three cases. Now, by the way, these were at 100 part per billion concentrations. So they were fairly high concentrations. But you can see that the signal-to-noise ratio there is actually quite excellent. You can see that there are spectral features that are unique, and the ratios are unique to each of these PAHs. And if you look at a region at about 650 wave numbers, look at all three spectra at around 653 wave numbers, you can see that the upper trace, the green one, has a single little peak to the left. Just below that, the red one has a single little peak to the right. And just below that, there's no real discernible peak there. So even just in that little region, you can see that each of these spectra have unique spectral identifying features that can be used as part of the library matching situation. Another thing to point out is that the in this case, the laser nominal that was used was a nominal power at 25 milliwatts, but the measurement time was only 10 seconds. So we believe that if potentially this method could get out in the field and make very fast, ultra-sensitive measurements. Okay, now let's see. It looks like I lost the screen. Oh, there we go. No, I didn't. Okay, now
yeah,
I'm back.
I think it's fine.
Okay, I'm now on the summary screen. Sorry about that. Okay, so in summary, we partnered with UMass at Amherst, and they were able to synthesize these alkane thiol-based hydrophobic partition layers, and were able to apply them onto our SIRS substrates. This process underwent many cycles of optimization, both the SIRS substrate and the partition layer, and I think that we've demonstrated that we achieved sufficient sensitivity for this application of measuring pHs in Superfund groundwater. The excellent signal-to-noise ratio SIRS spectra were obtained for all target 16 PAHs, and these spectra are sufficiently rich in spectral content to serve very well as spectra to fill a library database. Calibration curves were constructed successfully for three of the PAHs, which is what we proposed in the phase one, with limits of detection of 0.1 part per billion and potentially lower. I might just add here that we did time-resolve SIRS signals to show how effective the extraction of the PAHs from waterborne PAHs, how effective it is. And within 5 minutes, the signal reaches about, once the sample is applied to the substrate, within about 5 minutes, the sample reaches about 10% of its maximum value, compared to a sample that's been where the sample was applied for 20 hours. In 10 minutes, it reaches just about half of that value. Clearly, these are detectable levels that were measured with one of the PAHs at 0.1 part per billion. So we think that even out in the field with no further optimization, that within 10 minutes you ought to be able to make a very sensitive measurement in the field. We've submitted a phase two that is currently under review, and in that phase two we'll optimize it even further, with our goal to be to have a result from time that you apply the sample to the instrument within 1 minute. I see my contact information is listed there. I would encourage people that have experience out in the field with their muddy boots on, digging around in groundwaters, to contact us to teach us how to effectively address the groundwater samples at Superfund sites. In our phase two proposal, we listed a local Superfund site that we will be visiting. But I noticed that in the list of registrants, there were several folks from the EPA. I'd like to hear from you and learn how most effective, some of the limitations that you might have seen here, and some of the effective ways that we can go out and sample out in the field. Thank you very much, Heather, for the opportunity to talk here, and thanks to everybody for taking the time to listen, and I'd like to field any questions that we might have.
Thank you, Wayne, and Lily, too, and the others who are working on your team. And speaking of local Superfund, where is local for you?
We're in Woburn, Massachusetts.
Okay.
There's a Superfund site that's about 5 miles away.
Okay.
That's listed as having PAHs.
Okay, great. And hopefully some of our EPA colleagues on the line will take you up on that offer.
I invite that.
Yeah, that's great. So we do have a number of questions, and why don't I go ahead and start with those. After a couple minutes, I'm going to open up the phones for their questions. So if you are on the phone line, I will give you a chance in just a minute. For now, a question came in about the pinpointer and whether this spectrometer is something that you made or did you adapt an existing handheld spectrometer for this?
The pinpointer is one of Agiltron's commercial products.
Okay.
You can actually go to our website and buy one if you want.
Okay.
And that's what that's why we can wrestle one away from the commercial folks and get our hacksaw out and start to cut it open so we can modify it and they don't screen too much.
Okay, fair enough. And this is a good question. There are potentially hundreds of non-target PAHs in an environmental sample. So how can you guarantee that the spectra will not interfere?
Well, there's two ways to do that. One is that only the hydrophobic components will come in and be detected. Now, there could be a lot of other hydrocarbon components, but we have three ways that we will deconvolute this complicated measure spectra that we collect from a water sample. One is our conventional library search mechanism, which is simply a correlation calculation that compares the goodness of fit, or that compares the similarity of the measured spectra to the spectra in the library. We also have a more robust method that we use for spectra that don't show a lot of spectral feature, and that is a pattern recognition process that does a least squares fit to a linear combination of all the library spectra. And so it will then be able to see if, for example, you had two of those PAHs at the equal concentrations, it would determine that based on the spectra that exists. The other thing is that if we had 16 spectra in the library, we'd actually have 17 potential outcomes. One of them would be no match. Okay, so if there was no linear combination that would fit the spectra completely or partially, that would indicate that none of the library spectra represent any analyte that's in the sample, and that would be a conclusion, that at least a preliminary conclusion, that the PAHs did not exist in the sample. There was nothing about that spectrum that resembled any combination of those PAHs. But the third, maybe the most powerful one, And Lily, if you're able to speak to this, please speak up. But Lily also is an expert with principal component analysis, and so she can extract out slight differences from measured spectra and determine if they can be fit into as principal components, and we can then compare those results or include those results in our interpretation.
Sounds good. Mm-hmm. And there's Lily.
Yeah, can I add something in? So another strategy in the phase two we want to do is to select different partition layer that has selectivity to the 16 priority pH, which means different partition layer, they maybe have different sensitivity, which provides selectivity. So with that optimized partition layer, we were able to have the selectivity for our target. Thanks.
That makes a lot of sense. Thanks for answering that question. Another question came in. How will the calibration curves perform in mixtures? That's kind of a similar to the question before, but I think by mixtures, you know, there could be metals or other types of things. And what about the presence of other interfering hydrophobic compounds? So perhaps you sort of already touched on this, but maybe you could add a little bit more in terms of mixtures.
Okay, well, here's something that's really kind of cool about the whole thing. Raman, to produce Raman spectra, the interaction of the incident light with the molecule requires that the molecule be fairly polarizable, that its dipole moment is changeable. This is actually the case with PAHs because they're so heavily pi bonded with all the carbon-carbon, with all the benzene light, like an aromatic bonds that exist. So PAHs are going to have a much higher, maybe 1 to 2 orders of magnitude higher cross-section, so a higher sensitivity to those, than let's just say for a normal alkane or a straight chain alkane. So the Raman process itself lends itself very nicely to aromatic type hydrocarbons like PAHs. So that is one way that it could differentiate between other hydrophobic hydrocarbons. And then, of course, any hydrocarbon that is not that is polar, of course, won't gravitate and won't extract out into the hydrophobic layer.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Soils were mentioned. Do you have a field-based extraction method in development for surface soil extraction?
We mentioned that in the in our phase two proposal that pHs exist both in soils and in water. We don't have one right now, but we'd certainly be receptive to the idea of incorporating procedures from people that have experience in that area.
Okay, great. Sounds like another opportunity for partnerships.
Right.
From our knowledgeable audience. Great.
Yep.
Last question we have online is how reproducible are your SIR spectra as a function of location on the silver nanoparticle substrate?
In the blanket answer for all of the calibration curve measurements is that it's 10% or better. Each of those data points was the average of 8 or more measurements at different parts of the SIRS, different regions of the SIRS substrate when the sample was placed. And so I would say there's probably an uncertainty of about 10%. However, since our detection limit is 0.1 part per billion or below, even if you're at 1.1 part per billion and you have a variability of 10%, that's still going to be way below the maximum concentration limit that the EPA selected. So it's still, at 10%, still well within an acceptable reproducibility range for this application.
That makes sense. Another question came in. With partition layers, you only have partial selectivity to PAHs, so are you planning to use an array of layers to solve the problem?
Just like Lily mentioned, we can use different partition layers and to to maximize the attractiveness, I guess, or the extraction capability for the different PAHs. Now, the PAHs are fused rings, and so they are very nonpolar materials, but the length of the alkane chain on the alkane thiols, we've taken steps to optimize them to some extent, but not fully. But we'll handle that in the phase two.
Great. Can't do it all at once, right? So I wanted to give people on the phones an opportunity to ask questions. In order to take the phone off mute, please hit #6, and then that will unmute your line. So we'll give phone participants a second to chime in if they have any questions.
Hello. Hi, this is Vikas.
Hi, Vikas.
Hi. I have a question for Wayne. Looks like this is a very sensitive technique, and you have this alkane layer modified over the silver nano films, and this has a limited capacity. But I think you have shown very great data, very low concentrations, but what happens if there are other hydrophobic compounds? Those are not PAHs, but they are in a much higher concentration, so it would be competing for the absorption of the site, and then it might, you know, if there are other less toxic or non-toxic hydrophobic organic compounds, that will take all the sites on that one, and it may not even detect the PAH. How will you overcome that challenge?
Well, we'll have to address that as we'll cross that bridge when we get to it, is what I'm saying. There is the potential for strong interferences by other hydrophobic analytes. At this point, what we'll say is that given the high cross-section of the PAHs compared to other hydrocarbons and the fact that the number of nonpolar hydrocarbons that might exist in groundwater are limited. So if a site is contaminated with PAHs, it's because something put the PAHs there. They don't occur all that in all that high concentration naturally. So if, for example, a sample had octane that was at an extremely high level, you have to realize that nothing's going to be there at a very high level because these compounds are not very soluble in water. So it's not as if one of the hydrocarbons is going to be five orders of magnitude higher concentration than PAHs. PAHs are considered to be insoluble in water, but at the part per billion level, they exist.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Are there any other questions from the phone line participants? If so, just hit #6, and that will unmute your line. We're not hearing questions at the moment, but again, contact information is available on the slide that we're looking at now and is also associated with the seminar webpage. And we certainly encourage those of you who participated today to get in touch with our investigators, our grantees, at any point and follow up if there were points of interest or further clarification or even ideas about how to make the technology more applicable or even broadly applicable. So before we conclude, I want to make sure everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. And again, we certainly encourage you to forward these archives on to some of your colleagues because I think the information included today was very interesting. So also in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling this out. We look at your comments, and we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. New ways to stay connected. So I want to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's Clue-In webinars, please refer to the Clue-In website, EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page, EPA Cleanup Tech page on Twitter. You can also join the Cleanup Network Information Network on LinkedIn. And we encourage you to visit the SRP Progress and Research webpage. That's where we will keep references to this particular archived webinar series. And then also follow SRP on NIEHS Twitter's page. So if there are no more questions, and I see that we have not gotten any additional questions in the Q&A, we are at a point where we can thank our presenters, Mark Peterman from Ondivia, Bikas Fida from Lintech, and Wayne Wiemar of Algitron, and Lily He from UMass Amherst. And want to thank you for preparing and sharing your presentations today. Again, these are recipients of the Superfund Research Program Small Business Grants. Those are SBIR, Small Business Innovative Research, as well as STTR, Small Business Technology Transfer Research Grants. And if you have any questions about that research program, you're welcome to contact me. I'm the point of contact for the Superfund for that research program. We certainly want to thank the folks at EPA and Clue-In for their help, both in front of the scenes and behind the scenes, in letting us do this webinar series via Clue-In. And that would be Jean Ballant and Peter Riddle. We also want to thank Sarah Mishmandani and Justin Crane for all of their help behind the scenes as well. So at this time, we're going to conclude today's presentation. Thank you very much for your participation, and we hope to have you all tune in for our next SRP webinar, which is going to start April 25th, and it's going to feature research in water technologies, and that includes health as well as community engagement, as well as solutions. So we hope that you will tune in for that as well. Thank you very much for your participation today, and at this time we're going to conclude the webinar.